Yeah, they're always saying, oh, he invented like 1,500 words. They never talk about how he's responsible for the deaths of young men in Los Angeles in the 21st century.
Shakespeare invented the taser. You heard it here first. Hello, friends, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week we try and uncover the best of the worst. I am Ben Vandeveld. Do you hear the people singing the song of angry men? Well, yeah, I do. And if you have some sort of issue at work, that's very much something you'll have to take up with HR. It is the music of people who will not be slaves again. Well, if you're going to bring up accusations of slavery, then we're going to have to take this to a tribunal. When the beating of your heart echoes the beating of the drum. Well, I'll level with you, sir. That sounds like some sort of arrhythmia, and you're going to have to go down to the health department and see if you can get some sort of benefits. There is a life about to start when tomorrow comes. Actually, fuck it. Here's your P45. Get out of my office. And with me today is the angrily worded placard to my flaming pitchfork. It is Barry McStay.
I tell you what, the lyrics of Les Mis sound great in a Geordie accent. Jean Valjean.
Yeah, that's like
Jean. Les Miserables.
Oh, Gavroche, mate.
Yeah, the Gavroche sounds like a French version of a stotty, doesn't it? It's like a stotty just with bechamel all over it instead of cheese. Oh no, I'm thinking of Parmo, isn't it? Which is your people's.
That's my neck of the woods. Yeah, I think Gavroche sounds more like a kind of Belgian fondant fancy.
Yeah, delicious pastry.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, do you know what? I think that Barry Rutter at Northern Broadsides, we could persuade him to do a Geordie version of Les Miserables.
Oh, I'm sorry to break it to you, Ben, but Barry Rutter is no longer of Northern Broadsides.
I know.
No, it's alright, he's not dead.
Ravens have left the tower, though.
Yeah, he has stepped down because they didn't get their Arts Council. This is so dorky. They didn't get their Arts Council grant increased in the last funding round. And he said that if we don't get it increased by 25%, I'm going to step down. And no one got their grant increased by 25% because there isn't any fucking money. But he was as good as his word.
Yeah.
And he stepped down in a kind of really dignified huff.
Yeah. Wow, I did.
Really dignified round of interviews with the press, huff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, yes. He just sort of struck me as the Eric Cantona of regional theatre. So that sort of.
There's someone in the front row not listening to his lectures. Getting a kick to the face.
Haven't we all wanted to do that to an audience member at one time or another?
And he wears a cravat in exactly the way Cantona used to wear that folded up collar.
Yeah, that's true. For people who are not au fait with the British theatre scene, this is a baffling start to the show.
And for people who don't know about the 1993-1994 football season, this is a baffling start to the show. So goodbye, North America, once again. We'll see you in a few minutes.
Yeah, just skip ahead to we'll put a timestamp somewhere in this. Listen, I'll introduce our guest. Today's guest is an award-winning, internationally touring performer, writer, and director. His current primary focus is writing, performing, and touring his solo theatre shows, including How to Occupy an Oil Rig, Going Viral, and Instructions for a Border Crossing. And he also creates shows for younger and community audiences and non-theatre spaces. His shows are a potent mixture of the provocative and the comic. In The Price of Everything, he presents a performance lecture about the difference between the price and value of things, while also providing with a free glass of milk. He invites audience interaction and intervention, creating theatre about the world we live in and our choices about how we live in it. Chances are, by the end of this show, you'll be hosting it, and Ben and I will be considering what we've been doing with our lives. He's been described as astute and stylish by The Stage, captivating and illuminating by The Independent, and the future of British theatre by The Times. Sadly, for the moment, he just finds himself as merely the present of Worst Foot Forward.
Daniel Bye. The future of British theatre was about 12 years ago. So I think now, if I'm not the present, I'm the past.
The future's a long time away still.
That's true, yeah.
As long as it was on a cosmological scale, that's fine.
It was about 2005, I think. I live in hope.
Can I say, by the way, I've got an ulcer on my tongue, which is making reading that introduction extremely painful.
I should also say, for the benefit of the two people who were in How to Occupy an Oil Rig with me, that one wasn't a solo
Plasma sure. Mod the genre.
They were not figments of the audience's imagination. Jack and Catherine, it's okay, you exist.
I'm sorry, oh. Jack and Catherine.
But you were very much the terrorist mastermind of that occupation.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And they're both now serving time.
So you were the one telling people how to do it, and then they were the ones who actually carried it out.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. I was the Steve Smith to their Cameron Bancroft. More niche sport, Joe.
Yeah, really sorry, North America. Really sorry.
We always ask our guests what they're worst at in the world. What would you say that would be for you?
Oh, I mean, it's a long, long list. But I memorably put up some shelves recently in the guest bedroom of our house, because not living in London, we have two guest bedrooms.
Wow. Ooh, larger yeah, door.
Things going very well with these. You can afford to pay two people and put up shelves in a spare bedroom.
Yeah, well, I mean, I put up the shelves myself. I didn't pay someone to do it. And therein was the problem. So I put up the shelves in the guest bedroom, and 2 days later... while a guest was in the guest bedroom, down they jolly well came.
Where had you positioned them?
On the wall.
Above the bed?
Oh, not above the bed. No, there were no injuries. It did knacker the printer, which was sitting on the desk underneath that. But what happened was the top shelf came down, and it kind of left the bottom shelf sort of dangling. Mm. So having failed spectacularly to put up these shelves and potentially caused serious injury in the process, I then tried to get the bottom shelf unscrewed from the wall, and it was just stuck. So I'd somehow managed to put up one quarter of the hanging for these shelves to the extent that it was impossible to get it out. And the other three just fell out. The other three corners came down. And what I ended up doing was paying someone to deal with the damage.
There's a reason why we're on stage and then techies do their techie stuff. Me and my wife are currently trying to make our flat. We're nesting for oncoming baby, and there is nothing more emasculating. He
keeps coming back with twigs in his mouth.
Yeah. Mate, I've been goggling worms for a week.
That's a familiar scene. I'm so sorry.
Nothing more emasculating than seeing my spherical, heavily pregnant wife brandishing a power drill to stick pictures in the wall because I don't know how to do it. Like, it's a very beautiful modern sight, and I don't mind because she's extraordinarily capable, but I feel your DIY pain.
Yeah, I mean, I missed out the bit where Sarah came in holding the baby in order to try and help, and I just totally lost my shit. We'll pass over that in a sort of undignified silence.
Yeah, at least you make an effort though, Ben. When a light bulb goes in our flat, I just send a text to my husband going, can you pick up some light bulbs and replace it when you get back, please? He's definitely the DIY person in the relationship.
Oh, cool. That's right. As long as you've made peace with it. I have not.
Yeah, no, it's very good. I'm completely happy with having a surrogate parent as a husband.
That's a really complicated sentence to unpack.
Yeah, it's a little bit Oedipal, but there we go.
Yeah, that sort of brings us very circuitously to this week's subject.
I gave you a Christmas present there, and it was wrapped, and you could say, that looks like a segue. I'm just going to unwrap it. Oh, it is a segue.
Yeah, and I'm now going to drive it off a cliff. This week we are going to be talking about theatre, but specifically the world's worst political theatre. Now, I know that I've never been in a political theatre play, to my knowledge. Of either of you two lads, I mean, a lot of your stuff sort of political, isn't it, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, all of my stuff is political. I would argue that Oedipus is pretty political. It's about a king who fails at his rule for a series of problems to do with his own personal failings, and you know, and also the gods, they don't help. I would also argue that all theatre is political, but that could get a bit theory heavy podcast, so I'll see how I'll take the temperature in about 15 minutes. Maybe I'll drop that theory bomb a bit later on.
I want to see the essay describing why jukebox musical Mamma Mia is political theatre.
Okay, well, I'll try and do it in like 3 sentences.
Banging.
All theatre is political because all art is a depiction of the way we are living in the world. If a piece of art, a piece of television doesn't address explicitly, doesn't think about the ways in which all the choices we make are political choices, then it is simply an endorsement of the status quo. Mamma Mia is an endorsement of a fairly tedious, kind of patriarchal, soft capitalist world in which the happiest possible ending to all of life is a lovely heteronormative marriage.
That was a beautiful triple tuck with backwards dismount from that challenge I led you.
Is she a single mum in Mamma Mia? Could you imagine in Mamma Mia if it had been done like in the 80s?
Oh, but she's so happy that there are these three options
that
to
they
choose
show up.
From.
Yeah.
Three very formulaic options. By the way, welcome back, North Americans, and goodbye, sports fans.
I mean, I should also say that I've not really seen Mamma Mia. So. Yeah.
I had it forced upon me once against my will.
Of course you did. Yeah. Your wife's infamous taste in cinema.
Yeah, it was probably a trade-off between I'm going to do the grouting and then we're going to watch Mamma Mia. Yeah. Fair enough, darling, that'll do.
I mean, this conversation is also an endorsement of various heteronormative values.
No, his wife has a terrible taste in film.
Barry, you're going to start us off with your suggestion for the worst piece of political theatre.
Cool. I did a bit of reading around the subject, of course.
Mm-hmm.
One of the more recent political theatre sort of controversies I can remember is the public theatre in New York, who do the Shakespeare in the Park, their production of Julius Caesar last year, where they depicted Caesar as a Trump-like figure. I say Trump-like. He tweeted in a golden bath. He had blonde hair and wore red ties and a Slavic wife. It wasn't the most subtle depiction of Julius Caesar ever. And, I mean, it's a reasonably obvious decision. The Bridge Theatre in London are doing Julius Caesar at the moment with a similar sort of despotic figure. And it led to the New York production, obviously, led to a lot of protests, with audience members invaded the stage on occasion and said things like stop political violence against conservatives. There was lots of people like Fox and various other places had headlines saying assassination of Trump depicted on stage without, and then would sort of bury five paragraphs in what the actual play was, you know, things like that. And it was around the time that the Republican Congressman Steve Scalise was shot at that congressional baseball match or whatever, football match. And so that had happened around the same time. So people say, this is exactly why you shouldn't have this thing. Even though if anybody actually were to read or see Julius Caesar, they'd realise it depicts the assassination of a populist and popular leader by a group of elites who then do not succeed in their goals. If anything, it is a warning against political violence.
I mean, it's a warning against everyone. It's a warning against Trumpian, Julius Caesarian kind of demagoguery as well.
Mm.
And the dangers of whipping up crowds through that kind of populist rhetoric. But the thing that I enjoyed about that particular sort of fracas in New York was The and this is particularly the case in America, but I think it's true here as well. The right are really keen on free speech until it's against them.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
Then it has to be shut down immediately.
Yeah, that's true.
Free speech, pro-free speech activists are so often people hijacking free speech arguments in order to give them the right to proclaim their proto-fascist views. Like, yeah, of course you're allowed to say that. I'm allowed to say that I think you're a fucking idiot.
Yeah, sure.
It doesn't mean I'm breaching your freedom of speech by telling you that I think you should shut up.
The problem with defending freedom of speech is that very often the people you're defending are the worst in society, but that's the way freedom of speech works.
Yeah, Donald Trump Jr. tweeted something along the lines of, when does art become political speech? And sort of saying, oh, are our taxes funding this? If it's political speech, would we be funding? You'd be going, have you ever seen any art?
Yeah.
I imagine you're a fan of Mount Rushmore.
I think we might have said this before, but I'm still staggered that a year and a bit into Trump's presidency that Mount Rushmore hasn't been converted into just four Trump heads.
It's very true. Or him and the three kids, you know.
Or him and his three wives.
Yes. A couple of sponsors obviously pulled out in the wake of all the protests, including Bank of America and Delta. Funnily enough, in New York City in 2012, the acting company produced a version of Julius Caesar where Caesar was portrayed as an Obama-like figure and the protests were sort of centred around the Occupy movement. And guess what? Delta had sponsored that very same production and there was no outcry about the Obama figure being assassinated. A little interesting aside, the only change they made to the entire script for the Shakespeare in the Park thing was the line, If Caesar had stabbed their mothers, they would have done no less. So they're saying that basically Caesar can do no wrong in the eyes of the public. And they just inserted the words "on Fifth Avenue" into that single line to make sure people really got the reference. Caesar, by the way, there was a production of Julius Caesar in 1864 where John Wilkes Booth played Mark Antony.
What?
Yeah. The year before he had killed Lincoln.
Right.
Yeah, no, it wasn't like he didn't even go to prison. They shot him when they were chasing him down. I mean, are you imagining like a prison production of Caesar?
I was imagining that and then trying to work out whether John Wilkes Booth was like going undercover and scoping out the theatre and sort of he was on stage working out angles where it would be best to shoot someone in the box.
Something else that I didn't know is the word robot originated in the piece political theatre. So Karol Čapek, who's the Czech writer who, he was nominated for the Nobel Prize 7 times, didn't win once. He was like the Peter O'Toole of the Nobel Prize. He wrote a play called Rossum's Universal Robots, or RUR, which is a play about sort of, they're not really robots as we know them today, they're more androids, they're sort of flesh slash mechanical, who replace the working class as worker drones and then eventually actually rise up and kill the humans. One of the other more famous socialist plays is Waiting for Lefty by Clifford Odets, which is about cab drivers in New York discussing whether they should strike and to get a pay rise. And it was performed over here and it was performed in New York. It was apparently so powerful. So the idea is Lefty is this mob, or not mob, he's this union leader who they're waiting to arrive at this meeting, and the actors treat the audience as members of the union in a union meeting, and they break the fourth wall and they chat to them, and by the end of it they learn that Lefty's been shot on his way to the meeting, and they're chanting strike, 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 and the audience spontaneously joined in and rushed the stage in the very first performance in New York. It was that powerful, apparently.
I think Waiting for Lefty should definitely be a fringe production of a rewrite of Waiting for Godot, but starring Phil Mickelson, who then never turns up. Neat sports joke, guys. Very neat sports joke.
Still trying to keep them on board, Ben.
Yeah, I am.
Can't sit on this fence.
That one, I've missed that one.
Phil Mickelson is an American golfer whose nickname is Lefty, and I always thought it's because he was left-handed, and it's not. It's because he's actually a very left-wing person.
So it was the American sports joke that defeated me.
Yeah.
Theatre was banned in 1642 here in the UK by the Long Parliament at the sort of the outbreak of the Civil War, because at these times of humiliation, plays are full of lascivious mirth and levity. They were not acceptable. So you'd imagine when the war was over that they might put plays back on. No. Puritans and Cromwell got in and they just reinforced that law in 1648 and said actors were no better than rogues, and theatre spectators could be fined and theatre seating demolished.
So I thought it was Cromwell that banned theatre, but it was pre-Cromwell.
Well, Parliament had banned it anyway, right, but you think so at the end of it.
Parliamentarian.
Yeah, he's parliamentarian. I read about some banned plays as well. Lysistrata by Aristophanes. When it was first performed in Florence, so that's the one about the war between Sparta and Athens, and the women go on strike, of the women of all the city-states of Greece go on sex strike and withhold sex from their men to try and make peace with each other, basically.
Funnily enough, Northern Broadsides did a production of it a couple of years ago.
Yeah, they did.
Under the title, was it called Lisa's Sex Strike?
Something like that,
But it was the same thing. It was about the women withholding sex from their men. Again, sort of problematic sexual politics when you look at it with the hindsight of several waves of feminism.
It's true. And back in those days, it wasn't popular with the politicians. Very popular with the audiences, apparently, because they would have seen it as very funny that women were, you know, exercising any sort of power.
Yeah, and also very funny with the audiences because they were all men.
Men, exactly.
Were women not allowed?
Women would be killed. It was punishable by death for women to attempt to watch the play. That was a man's business. The extent to which ancient Greece, and Athens in particular, was punitively, vituperatively misogynistic, it defies belief. I won't go into detail.
You've got access to grind with the ancient Greeks. Yeah, we'll be here all day if that's where we're starting. a politician in Athens at the time, Cleon, had Aristophanes seized and tried to put him on trial, but he escaped punishment largely because audiences loved the play so much. But even up to the modern day, it's been banned. It was banned in the USA for about 50 years in the 1870s under laws that were meant to sort of prevent contraception, but they sort of shoved loads of sort of added laws in about not being able to send lewd materials and things, so you couldn't import any copies of Lysistrata.
Is women withholding sex being conflated with contraception?
I think maybe it was. And it was banned twice in Greece itself in the 20th century, once by the Nazis and once by the military government that succeeded the Nazis.
That's bad company.
Yeah. In 1788, King Lear was banned in Britain because it reflected George III's madness. Because obviously Lear goes mad in the play as well, so that was a slightly insensitive subject to present on stage.
And then in Alan Bennett's play, The Madness of George III,
yes,
he reads from Lear at the point he's recovering his sanity.
Exactly.
Oh, hey, Alan Bennett's quite good, isn't
he's
he?
A clever lad,
yes. Yeah.
But he's got an eye for
Oxford.
Detail. Yeah. And one other banned play, this is a bit more recent, Angels in America, obviously a massive sort of beacon of gay theatre in particular, and there was a production stage at Kilgore College in Texas in 1999, which, as you can imagine, a play about gays in Texas was met with lots of protests and threats of funding cuts and people picketing the theatre, and this is in a college.
Doing a seven-hour play in a college production, that is ballsy.
Well, the guys, they tried to sort of get round the protests and the objections of people by, you know, cutting some of the nude bits and cutting some of the sexy bits they were depicting on stage, but basically Tony Kushner got word of the production and wrote them a letter saying, no, you do the whole bloody play, guys, you go, you be you. Because it had been a production in Romania that had been met with violence the year before, and he was like, remember what happened in Romania, this is important. So one of the people who tried to subvert the production was a guy called Glenn Phillips, who was a local attorney who bought 150 of the 263 tickets for the first night, just in the intention of leaving him with a practically empty theatre. But the theatre got wind of what was going on and just resold the tickets and made, you know, an extra 150 seats.
Yes!
Money. And not only that, the protest just drew so much attention to the show that when they had $50,000 of funding cut by the local county, committee or the county commissioners cut $50,000 worth of funding, the sellouts that they had every single night covered their loss of funding.
Oh, what a lovely story.
Isn't it nice?
Yeah.
So that's all far too nice. Instead, for my world's worst bit of political theatre, I have chosen an incident from February 1601, which is a performance of Richard II, the Shakespeare play. And so Richard II, for those who don't know, he's depicted as a weak king who gives up his crown, and basically the worst thing you can do as an Oedipus and in a lot of Shakespeare's plays as a king is to sort of abandon your duty as a monarch. That's the most of the kings are sort of portrayed in very heroic lights, but the ones who aren't are those are who give up their duty. And in this case, it was commissioned to be performed by the henchmen of the Earl of Essex, who I think we've mentioned in a recent episode.
Yes, we did.
So they asked Shakespeare's company, the Lord Chamberlain's men, to do a performance of Richard II in the Globe in February 1601, and they were going to pay them 40 shillings more than their going rate to do it. And guess what happened the day after the performance?
They did not
they
get paid.
They attempted to depose Queen Elizabeth.
Bingo, bango, bongo. The Earl of Essex marched on London.
there are more. So the way in which Richard II is portrayed in that play is not just as a weak king, but specifically as an effeminate king.
Effeminate and
childless.
There's
loads of stuff about effeminacy and childlessness. And there's loads of little things in there that, intentional or otherwise, can be easily located as digs at Elizabeth. I think there's even some stuff in there about his painted face.
I think there is, yes. And there is a guy who says he overheard Elizabeth say on one occasion, I am Richard II, know ye not that. It may or may not be true, but certainly the parallels were very obvious to contemporaries.
It's also worth saying that Queen Elizabeth is widely believed to have had an affair with the Earl of Essex,
yes,
several years earlier, and that in the play, Bolingbroke, who is there, it's sort of suggested by the play, has a romantic history with Richard II,
yeah,
ends up on the other team in this depicted rebellion.
Yeah, well, we said when we were talking about Essex the other day, I didn't realise that it was suggested that he had an affair with her, as I understood it. It's that he always wanted to, partly because they had genuine chemistry, and also he was a greedy, old-fashioned aristocrat who wanted to get his grubby paws on the throne.
I think that's probably more likely to be true. But yeah, that rumour is quite widespread and well-believed, and even if the rumour itself isn't true, it's kind of presence in the popular discourse makes that depiction in the play feel like it latches onto that.
Yeah.
This sort of history that they've got.
And it's incredible with Essex, because if you learn about the history of Elizabeth I, she's rightly depicted as this incredible, powerful woman, but the number of threats and plots against her life for a good 30, 40 years, and it's incredible with Essex, who is essentially a weasel in a doublet, and he's the one who gets almost the closest to succeeding, because he gets into the court before she is defended with swords.
Yeah, he managed to actually seize the Lord Chief Justice and took him hostage. Mm. I think his hopes that the playing of Richard II would rile up the crowds of London were rather dashed, because nobody rushed to join his army.
I thought that it was a private performance that they had, actually. I thought it was meant to galvanise him and his followers.
I think they let in a few. Sort of, they thought, oh, well, word will get out and then people will know what the hell's going on. But no, it fizzled out, and by the end of the day, he'd been arrested.
It's amazing that the Lord Chamberlain's men got away with that.
Yeah, 17 days later, on the eve of Essex's actual execution, they played before the Queen herself in Whitehall.
Do you know what the play was?
I don't know.
I'd be fascinated to know what that was.
I couldn't find that out. I was really interested to know.
it's called
Julius Caesar.
I debated whether or not to, because this is a show that I saw about 10 years ago in the Edinburgh Festival, what I thought we were doing actually was world's worst interactive political theatre. Yeah. So I've really zeroed in here. But, you know, I think there's always a way of making something worse. And in putting on a show about the Holocaust, the way of making that worse for everyone is to make it interactive.
Oh, no. It's not immersive as well, is it?
Completely immersive.
No,
yeah.
Oh, that's
not just
a massive
sit in your seats interactive, but full on get in the back of the van immersive.
No,
I'm fascinated and scared to hear about this, but I also feel like the competition in this podcast is pretty much over with those opening sentences.
What I debated, because it was a horrible experience.
Yeah.
And I'll say some of the ways in which it was a horrible experience. It's sort of quite hard to be amusing at its expense, because it was so obviously aggressively crass and stupid.
Yeah.
And just offensive. Just deeply, deeply, outrageously offensive. So what I debated was whether or not I was going to look up the title of it, because I couldn't remember what it was called, having seen it 10 or it's probably 12 years ago. And I decided not to look up the title. I can remember the name of the theatre company, who I'm pretty sure no longer exists. They were called Badak Theatre Company.
Badak.
B-A-D-A-C.
Like, just if you, a T short of Bad.
That's exactly Badak. What, yeah. I always wondered if it was meant to be pronounced with a soft C and it was Badass Theatre.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
But it's. I don't think it is. So they corralled the audience in a van. They shouted at you. They got members of the audience to kind of gang up against other members of the audience. And it was meant to be this immersive experience of, you know, what it was really like. Because that's helpful and edifying for all of us. But one of the things that made it even worse, I said I'd come around to talking about theatre critics.
Oh, yeah.
And I was quite good friends with a couple of theatre critics at the time. Obviously, not anymore.
These relationships sour.
Yeah. Well, one of them's no longer a theatre critic. Oh, but two of them, these two theatre critics who'd been quite forceful in their choice of words around this show and had given it, I think, sort of one-star reviews. The artistic director of the company, who was also in the show, and I could be amusing about that, but then that would lay me open to quite he threatened them with violence. Like, he threatened to beat them up.
Beat up the critics.
Yeah. And it's like Stephen Berkoff levels of hysteria and self-aggrandizing.
Yeah, he's gone too deep in character there as well, hasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's a real rich vein of irony in violence against critics who dismiss the success of your show about the tendency of humans to violence. Just everything about it was a clusterfuck. And one of these critics, it wasn't just that they got sort of aggressive emails or whatever. He encountered him in a bar because you do in the Edinburgh Festival, don't you? You bump into people. Yeah. This guy pinned him up against a wall.
Jesus Christ.
This is not just threatening violence. This is really close to actual violence. And my memory is that this guy, Chris, got the police involved. Just said, you've got to have a word with this guy. I can't verify. I'm not 100% certain that that happened, but I'm pretty sure that that the police said to this guy, I don't think they gave him a sort of formal cease and desist or an exclusion zone. I'm not even sure that existed at the time.
Yeah.
That they gave him a bit of a warning. Just watch your step, Sonny Jim.
I mean, well, if it's Scottish police, I'd like to think that they too then took that theatre director and pushed him up against a wall. And he had to get in touch with the Scottish Mafia, who put the police up against a wall, and it was just a circular lady who swallowed a fly, violent.
Do you have any memory of the striking images of this show?
I just remember being in the back of a van. I don't know if it was an actual van or if it was a kind of theatricalised van, but it was, you know, quite a small audience thing, maybe 20, 25 people. So I just remember being in the back of this van-type environment.
Yeah.
And I just remember them shouting at us. Just get over there. Fucking get over there. Fucking sit down. Don't fucking do that. Stand up. Sit down. It was just horrible. It was a traumatic and upsetting experience, and they would say, well, it was meant to be a traumatic and upsetting experience. But I don't think that replicating violence is the best way of discussing violence. It's just more violence.
Yeah, and as someone who works a lot in interactive theatre, you basically sign a contract with the audience that this is going to feel fairly realistic, but there is a level of safety underpinning all of this.
Yeah.
And you are going to give us permission to go a certain distance with you, and we are not going to make you feel at any point like you are unsafe.
Yeah, and they massively violated that.
Particularly if
that
they're turning audience members against each other.
Yeah, and pushing people around. Yeah. And, you know, it was way beyond that line. And, you know, I have to tread carefully here, because here I am in London, because I'm performing my show this week, which is an interactive piece of political theatre. And one of the sort of pat things that's always done by a lot of interactive political theatre, or even non-interactive political theatre, is that they sort of implicate the audience. You're just sitting there watching this. You didn't intervene.
Yeah.
You didn't intervene to stop Macbeth killing King Duncan. Well, no, because it's a fucking play.
Because if I did,
I'd ruin it.
Hey, yeah, if I did, let's see you do the second half, mate.
But it's a really A-level standard of understanding.
Yeah.
But as soon as you get into using participation, that sort of tendency in the analysis of the world that the work is suggesting is really prevalent. And, you know, I kind of do it as well in my show. But I think that there's, it's possible to use the practice of participation as a way of discussing the ethics of participation.
Mm.
There's just a way of doing that without being a dick about it. Like, these people have paid to come and see your show. It's just fucking rude to then insult them for having done so rather than being out on the barricades.
It's also, obviously the Holocaust is a really tricky subject to make theatre about, and I imagine that a fair amount of people who will go and see a piece of theatre about it may have some emotional or even familial connection to the Holocaust. And so putting middle and old age Jewish theatre goers inside a van and then recreating what happened to their ancestors.
I can't even speak.
It's like saying, no, we're going to do a piece of play all about the triangular Atlantic trade. Where we're doing it? On a boat? No, I'm out. Absolutely out.
Well, do you know what? There was a show, it's almost like a performance installation. It came to the Barbican, I think, about 3 or 4 years ago. It was called Plan B. It was by a white South African artist. And without wanting to be too blasé, it's not like there's any history of trouble from that community. And that's grotesquely unfair on a lot of noble white South Africans. But he made this show about the transatlantic slave trade, which was, it was basically a reenactment of the sort of human zoo, which was a thing in the 19th century where there would essentially it was black people in cages for exhibition, and black people in cages being kind of goaded into various kinds of extreme behaviour.
Oh, I read about this. This was astonishingly horrible.
And this this project, therefore, by a white artist, was a lot of black people in cages. And you can say that it's an attempt to recreate in order to critique that kind of thing, which used to happen and to some extent is still deeply ingrained in our culture. But also, you're just a white man who's put a lot of black people in cages.
Yeah.
I don't think that's your art to make. And a lot of white people found it very powerful, and a lot of black people found it deeply troubling, upsetting, and offensive. And I think I'm going to listen to them.
Yes. On this.
And of course, there were dissenting voices on both sides of that. Like, yeah. It would be absurd to say that there was a binary reaction depending on the colour of your skin. But certainly, when a majority of black voices are raised in dissent in a piece of work which depicts the subjugation of black people, yeah, I'm not going to go.
Time to listen to those guys, I think.
Yeah.
You've got to wonder about the rehearsal process of stuff like that. I remember going to see 12 Years a Slave, and the guy I watched it with said, like, if I was a white actor performing in that, then at the end of every scene I'd have to go up to my scene partner and just go, I'm really very sorry indeed.
Yeah.
Because you have to perform to show that unflinchingly, because that's the story, but nevertheless.
Yeah.
Well, it's also like the contrast between 12 Years a Slave and that, what was that grotesque Quentin Tarantino movie on
Django,
the same
Django and Chains.
Just like, that's what you get if you give that subject to a white guy and to a black guy.
Yeah.
I mean, and again, it's a bit of a strong binary to draw. Quentin Tarantino is an outlier in everything.
Yeah. I mean, the most offensive piece of racial profiling in Django Unchained was Quentin Tarantino's attempt at an Australian accent.
I don't know.
Listen, at least one of the three of us has to be glib about this. And since I'm the only one here whose family have suffered from genocide, I'm going to be the one. Look at the Irishman over there.
How dare you?
How very dare you?
Who had a famine anyway?
Can I just say to everyone, I'm very sorry.
On behalf of the people of Middlesbrough.
I read a quote from John McGrath, who was the founder of 784, one of the big political theatre companies in the 70s. He said, theatre can never cause a social change. It can be the way people find their voice, their solidarity, and their collective determination. And I read that in one of those regular articles you get every 2 or 3 years by a theatre critic who goes, political theatre is dead. Mm-hmm. People are making political theatre and it's always saying stuff. It's preaching to the converted. It doesn't actually make anything happen. But then she was like, not like the great political theatre of the 70s. And then quoted John McGrath saying, political theatre cannot cause a change.
Oh my God, they're talking about political theatre the way people talk about the magic of the FA Cup.
Yeah.
It's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. Not like the 70s.
Because everything's fine now, as you have noticed.
Everything was better in the 70s when it was just mud and boots and beards.
Is this political theatre or the FA Cup?
Yeah, that's what 784 were.
Yeah.
Mud and boots and tour van. That preaching to the converted thing always really gets my goat.
Yeah.
Partly because it's just factually inaccurate. If you talk to any theatre audience, there'll be some people who are there because they already agree with the artist in question. But most people are there, and this is particularly true when you do most of your work outside of London, as I do. Most people are there because it's what's on tonight and they want to have an evening out and they think that this will be interesting and they haven't necessarily made their minds up in detail about all of the issues. So that's the first reason that preaching to the choir or preaching to the converted annoys me. But the second one is that no one complains about preaching to the converted in a church. That's what preaching is. It's not about converting people. It's about galvanising the faithful.
Yes. And
actually, if you can manage both, then so much the better. And then, it's not necessarily about getting people to storm the stage shouting strike.
I mean,
Clifford Odets is an outlier in having actually achieved that. And then people genuinely did take to the streets after that show.
Yeah.
You don't have to manage that in that sort of agitprop way. You just dropping something in the water supply. It's tapping on the pipes in the prison. Yeah, it's planting a seed.
Yeah, if political theatre was preaching to conversions, they'd all be getting 5 stars. And as we all know, political theatre is some of the worst theatre.
Well, and it's always theatre critics who are complaining about the other people in the audience.
Yes. The wrong type of people.
Yeah, exactly. Like, dude, I might listen to them in that case. Because also there's more of them than there are of you. Can I just tell you my favourite 784 story?
Go on.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell people, listeners, who...
Oh, so 784 were a touring political theatre company in the 70s. They had branches in Scotland and branches in the north of England. John McGrath, who set it up, was originally, I think, from Liverpool, but then they spent quite a long time touring in Scotland. And they were called 784 because of the statistic that at the time, 7% of the country, 7% of the people own 84% of the wealth. It's worth saying as an aside that that theatre company, if formed now, would have to be called something like 198.
Yeah.
But they pulled up at some petrol station in the far north of Scotland with 784 emblazoned on the side of their van. And the guy at the petrol pump said, "What's that about? Why are you called 784? And they explained in the way that I just have. And he sort of thought about it, this guy, and he said, "Aye, but there's no need to boast about it."
Right, let's try and leaven the mood.
Go on. You're notoriously good at leavening. people.
Not this weekend, mate, of all weekends. I'm going back to Shakespeare's time to begin with. Because Shakespeare wrote some plays which were not that political, and one or two which were overtly political. And one of them is, I think, unwatchably bad and very difficult to stage in the 21st century, and that is Henry VIII.
I thought you were going to say Taming of the Shrew.
Oh, that's true. I was thinking of sort of like politics of state, but you're right.
I mean, Henry VIII is just boring.
Yes, yes. it's a boring hagiography. But yeah, the Taming of the Shrew is... I didn't even consider that. That is... which very much underlines the political problems.
Well, I think Taming of the Shrew actually is a really good example of a play which at its time would probably have been perceived as not a political play at all.
Yeah,
it's just a sort of funny knockabout comedy about wife beating. So it's knockabout comedy. Ha ha ha. Domestic violence is hilarious. It's a play about a man who marries a, quote, shrewish woman and disciplines her into becoming a good wife. It's a comedy, I should remind you. It's a comedy.
It's like the reverse of 50 Shades of Grey.
In some ways, that's
50 Shades of Kate.
Yeah.
Do you know how many horrible student productions that you've just given birth to?
I can't take it back now.
I'm sort of trawling my mind for quotes from Taming of the Shrew that connect. But, like, that's not a political play, ostensibly.
No.
But also, it's a, like, the speech that Kate gives at the end is a rousing endorsement of the virtues of patriarchal capitalism. And it's not a political play, because its politics were invisible, because so widely accepted as part of the fabric of reality, except that it is a political play, because it's a rousing endorsement of the status quo and the politics of the status quo.
The Mamma Mia of its time.
But the songs aren't as good.
No.
But that's like saying that, Othello was a political play at the time, but has become, I guess, more political as our racial politics have become more liberal.
Yeah, and it's... I think it's unquestionably the case that at the time, The Merchant of Venice was an anti-Semitic play, because everyone was anti-Semitic, and it's a comedy, and Shylock is the villain.
Mm.
He's a comedy villain with occasional moments of sympathy, because even when trying to write a comedy villain, Shakespeare can't quite help being brilliant.
Yeah.
But it's a really difficult play to reclaim now, because it is a comedy, and the guy who in Shakespeare's company played Shylock also played, for example, Falstaff and Sir Toby Belch in Twelfth Night. I wish I could remember the name of this actor now.
Kemp.
No, it wasn't Kemp, no, but he played all the comedy buffoon characters,
But it's the equivalent of like Steve Carell going from playing the comedy sidekick in Anchorman to being in Foxcatcher. Like some of them have that range, and I'd like to think this Shakespearean actor did.
Yeah, but then you look at the sequence of these roles, it's not about, maybe it's about range, but it's certainly not about him developing as an actor. Red Merchant of Venice is before Twelfth Night.
Oh, okay, so he disintegrated as an actor, maybe.
Yeah, or Shakespeare just thought, maybe trying to give him that has not a Jew eyes type stuff isn't really working. Let's just get him to pretend to be drunk.
Yeah, it's a good idea. And I can confirm that I do have eyes. But what they, I mean, even though it's troubling, at least Merchant of Venice is a meaty play made of brisket. But Henry VIII is just Shakespeare and his collaborator John Fletcher looking at the authorities, going, "Is this okay? Is this okay? Is this okay?" It opens with a prologue that stresses to the audience that they're about to see a serious play, and I can imagine at that point the groundlings just going, "Fuck this! We're off to get some roast chestnuts."
I always wonder whether that's a joke. Like, can you imagine walking on stage and saying, "Everyone, this is going to be very serious." You can't take that seriously.
You do that to a child. I like doing that to my husband's nephew, where you have to be very serious now, and it just sets him off. I mean, you can't stop laughing. Yeah. Come on now, this is extremely serious. Yeah. Stop it. Come on, serious time now. And you just go.
Whereas if you come on at the beginning of a comedy and say, "Everyone, this is going to be very funny," yeah, they're like, "Come on then." Oh, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, the problem is that Henry VIII then isn't funny.
No, the biggest issue with it is, so it's all around the machinations surrounding Cardinal Wolsey and the Duke of Buckingham and his machinations against the throne. But the opening few scenes are all about Cardinal Wolsey's abuse of the tax system for his own purposes. And I was thinking, what other story written by a great storyteller talks about a labyrinthine tax system in the early scenes? And it's the Phantom fucking Menace.
So, it's also Wolf Hall.
Oh, okay.
It's exactly the same. I mean, it's from a completely different perspective, but it starts with Cardinal Wolsey and his fall from grace, but has a bit more sympathy for Wolsey.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Wolf Hall is cracking, and the story of Wolsey and Henry VIII's court is a fascinating story, but this is not the way it needs to be told.
Yeah, like, it is true that it's the Phantom Menace, and like, the first three Star Wars films are about the eternal struggle between good and evil, and then the first prequel is about tax.
Yeah, you don't want the word wrangling to turn up in a sci-fi movie.
Only if it's
the name of an alien race.
Yeah, or cowboys in space.
Yeah.
During the second or third performance of Henry VIII at the Globe in 1613, a cannon shot was employed as a special effect that ignited the theatre's thatched roof and burnt the original building to the ground.
Yeah.
So that does feel a little bit like the fates were going, "Not this time, Shakespeare." But I can't pick a Shakespeare play as the worst political play.
Oh, well, the days are loaded.
Sorry, shots fired at your thatch. I've got one more before I tell you about my selection. Now, Barry's husband is a puppeteer and a very talented puppeteer, but I don't think he has ever engaged in political puppeteering, as far as I know.
The sort that Steve Bannon engages in, or?
Oh, very good. Actually, no. I take it back. Actually, he has. About 5 or 6 years ago, Mikey worked for, was it Greenpeace or Friends?
Yes.
Greenpeace, and he was puppeteering a giant 30 or 40 foot long polar bear.
Oh, I was on that march.
You were on that march?
Yeah. Yeah. About the size of a double decker bus.
Yeah,
Mikey. That was amazing.
Yeah. It was incredible. Mikey was inside the head.
Yeah.
It was cool. And actually, the contraption he was in, it sort of looked like the gun seat that Han Solo and Mark Hamill sit in the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah.
It was super cool.
Yeah, they marched this giant polar bear on the headquarters of Shell in London to protest drilling in the Arctic.
Well, that was a lot more cool than this company. Now, but it's the Bread and Puppet Theatre, who are a politically radical puppet theatre active in America since the 60s. Now, listen, they've done some interesting work. They were active during the Vietnam War, and they would make these giant 15 to 20 foot high papier-mâché puppets that would go on parades and marches and would sort of depict politicians and the key controversial issues of the day, and they focused a lot on things like the plight of Native Americans and Guatemalan and El Salvadorian Indians who are facing up against American imperialism. But they also made some fairly bad choices in recent times, particularly in December 2001, they made a piece called The Insurrection Mass with Funeral March for a Rotten Idea, a special mass for the aftermath of the events of September the 11th, which they described as a non-religious service in the presence of several papier-mâché gods, and was essentially a 45-minute critique of American foreign policy leading up to 2001, depicted via giant puppets.
Oh mate, I've got to say that sounds great.
I think I'd watch that as well. Were they good puppets?
No. You can watch it on YouTube, and it's like bad papier-mâché Henson puppets that have been manipulated by sixth formers.
Right.
And there's lots of sort of like big two-dimensional talking heads. And it's weirdly, a lot of the sort of the faces that are depicted, they look like sort of Aztec or Inca or Mayan murals.
Right.
And it looks shonky. It looks like the sort of thing.
Well, that's what it's meant. It's American foreign policy leading up to 9/11. Isn't it?
Very good. Very good.
This is Have I Got News For You, right?
Yeah. It looks like the sort of thing that I would walk past in one of the lesser fields at Glastonbury and just think, no, not for me. But the story I want to tell you, and it is one of my favourite stories I've ever discovered, is the story of the Astor Place riot.
Oh,
have you guys heard
Astor
about
Astor Place?
Astor, A-S-T-O-R.
As in Lady Astor and that family.
Maybe, don't know. This took place on May the 10th, 1849 in Manhattan. So you need to know a little bit of background for this. But this is a riot that eventually led to the creation of the first ever police force armed with deadly weapons. And the genesis...
This play must have been terrible.
The theatre is to blame for the well-armed militia.
This play was Macbeth.
What?
So, the background... And I just said before that I wouldn't pick a Shakespeare play. Anyway.
Another good example of a play whose job is to praise the status quo. I mean, it's explicitly written to flatter King James the First.
Yeah.
Was it?
Who was descended from Banquo... And a big fan of the occult, fascinated by witches.
Yeah, Lady Macbeth's line, "Look like the innocent flower, but be the serpent under it." A lot of people say, "Oh, it's an allusion to a Virgil quote where he says there's a cold adder lurking in the grass." But in the wake of the gunpowder plot, James had a medal minted depicting a load of flowers and a snake amongst them, and so theatre goers like celebrating him surviving and also but warning of the trouble of traitors, so people would very much have gotten the reference that line was relating to that.
That's so good.
Yeah. And there's an explicit reference in the bit where the witches are telling Banquo the thing about you shall not be kings, but your children shall be. Your children shall be kings, but you shall be none. Something like that is the line. Then there's a bit where there's a sort of parade of his ancestors.
Which is the terrible bit.
Yeah, it's always cut. Always cut in production. But basically, someone... is there to represent the future King James the First, like six or seven generations down the line, and to say, well, thank God we got rid of that bastard, Macbeth, who in the play seems to reign for about a fortnight, but actually presided over 13 years of fairly stable Scottish history.
Oh, wow. I love, like, this is...
With his wife, who was one of the more powerful women in Scottish history, Gruach, she was called. She had a name in real life.
Yeah, Gruach.
And is sort of reviled in the play, partly, I think, because... she's reputed to have been a successful, powerful woman.
Really? And one of the things in the play is they try and, as she becomes more powerful, they take away her feminine qualities. There's all that unsex me here stuff.
Yeah, she doesn't have them to start with, and they gradually remove her sanity.
Yeah. That's...
Say they. He.
Yeah.
Let's use the male pronoun here. It feels relevant.
On one side, I'm delighted by that little Easter egg that Shakespeare popped in there, although because it was in a puritanical time in England's history, they probably wouldn't refer to Easter eggs. And at the other time, I'm disgusted, even further disgusted by his sexual politics. But I'm more disgusted by Shakespeare's creation of the militarised police force in America.
200 years after his death.
Yeah, they're always saying, oh, he invented like 1,500 words. They never talk about how he's responsible for the deaths of young men in Los Angeles in the 21st century.
Shakespeare invented the taser. You heard it here first. Basically, in the mid 19th century, there was a big debate, cultural debate in America between... is our culture English and derived from English, or are we going to forge our new American culture? And this was best seen in the theatre. The dispute was between William Charles Macready, who was a very notable English actor at the time, like pretty much the Olivier of his day, and an American guy called Edwin Forrest. And they had this ongoing feud about who was the best actor in major roles of Shakespeare. Yeah. And basically, the theatre at the time, because there was no cinema, there was no radio, there was no professional sport, there were no fashion industry. These guys were the absolute superstars of the day. And the nature of the American theatre was, I guess, very much like, in my mind, theatre in classical times, that it was a public forum. It was a place for debate. And people would get much more emotionally engaged in what was happening in the way that Baddack Theatre Company would like, but very much misunderstood.
Yeah.
In the early 19th century, the American theatre was dominated by British actors like Macready. And so when Edwin Forrest popped up, the public in America adored him and turned him into a messianic figure. And one of the big problems in American theatre was that Shakespeare was still held up as this paragon, like correctly, because he's pretty good. But Americans had this issue of going, why are we holding up an English writer as a paragon whilst we're trying to forge American theatre? Anyway, that's sort of the background to it. And the alienation within the American public was also between the working class Americans, a lot of whom were Irish immigrants, and sort of the more upper class Americans who still didn't mind having a relationship with England and English culture. So here's the sort of the lead up to the riot. So Macready and Forrest both toured the other's country twice before the riot broke out. In a sort of
playing
like
the away match.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, obviously the stars and reviews counted double.
Yeah.
And the second time Macready visited America, what Forrest did is he started pursuing him around the country and appearing in the same plays as some sort of challenge to him. Which is so petty. I love it. And
this, just the poster for Macbeth, and they just pull a strip off the bottom and it's the other guy's name underneath. Change of date.
So what happened was during this sort of like great pursuit, like Macready was giving as good as he got and kept referring to Forrest as being a man without taste. But the biggest scandal happened on the third time that Macready went to America. And at this point, the audience really started hating him to the extent that half the carcass of a dead sheep was thrown at him whilst he was on stage. And that immediately made me think of when Luis Figo moved from Barcelona to Real Madrid. And when taking a corner, someone threw an actual horse's head at him.
Jesus Christ.
Oh yeah. God.
There's a dagger I see before. Oh, no, it's a sheep.
Yeah. The climate got even worse when Forrest, the American actor, instigated divorce proceedings against his English wife for immoral conduct. And the verdict came down against Forrest on the day that Macready arrived in New York for his farewell tour.
Wow.
So there's all sorts of bad blood swimming around. And you have to remember that at this time, this is in Manhattan, at the height of sort of the Gangs of New York feeling. So it's a really dangerous, violent area. So Forrest at this time, all of his portrayals of various parts, he tries to sort of galvanize, I guess, the working class men and women of New York. And I guess he's sort of instigating the Bruce Springsteen school of American acting. And so he makes sure that his acting is sort of muscular and impassioned and deeply American. And because the wealthier New York theatre goers didn't want to get involved in this, they instead went off to the Astor Place Opera House, which had been recently built near the junction of Broadway and Bowery. And Broadway was very much for the upper classes, and Bowery was for the working classes.
Mm. Very near where the Public Theatre is.
Yes,
yeah, yes. And the Astor Place Opera House had a dress code with gloves and white shirts and white tie. And it was the building of this opera house was seen as a provocation to the populist working class Americans. So, Macbeth. Macready, the English actor, was scheduled to appear in Macbeth at the Opera House. And Forrest was scheduled to perform Macbeth on the same night, only a few blocks away at the Broadway Theatre. So they're going toe-to-toe now on the very same night. On May,
they just shoved them in the same theatre. But put both companies on the stage
at the same time.
In a ring. In a ring, yeah. In an octagon.
Yeah. Two mix, Macbeths mix, enter.
Mix one. Macbeth art.
Lovely. Lovely work. So 3 nights before the riot, the supporters of Forrest, the American actor, in a move not unlike the one he talked about from Angels in America, bought hundreds of tickets to the top level of the Astor Opera House. But they didn't not turn up. Instead, they brought the performance to a grinding halt by throwing rotten eggs, potatoes, apples, lemons, shoes, bottles of stinking liquid, and ripping up the seats like 1980s British hooligans.
Wow.
And throwing them down. The performers persisted, even in the face of hissing groans and cries of shame, and down with the codfish aristocracy. But they basically performed a dumb show, and at the end of it, the audience rose and cheered, and also cheered when Forrest spoke the line, "What rhubarb senna or what purgative drug will scour these English hens?"
Wow.
Yeah.
Is that a line from Macbeth?
Apparently so.
Is it?
I don't remember that at all.
It's a great line. Yeah. Rhubarb Senna. Yeah.
Sorry, I should put it. Sorry, that happened at Forrest's performance. The rioters were Forrest supporters trying to destroy the English supporters at the English performance. So, after this performance, which was almost derailed by all of the abuse, Macready said, "Right, screw this, I'm leaving to Britain on the next boat." But he was persuaded to stay after 47 members of the New York elite signed a petition. These included people like Herman Melville and Washington Irving.
Right.
So this is, you know, this is the creme de la creme of New York society. And they said, "Listen, don't worry, good sense will prevail, you'll be all right." So 3 days later, on May the 10th, Macready takes the stage to perform Macbeth.
Macbeth.
Hello, Freud.
Yeah.
On the day that this riot took place, the police chief in New York, a guy called George Washington Matzell, informed the new mayor of New York, Caleb S. Woodhull, great 19th century American name, and that he didn't have enough sufficient manpower if a riot kicked off. So Woodhull basically called out a militia. Meanwhile, And this was a guy called General Charles Sanford, and he brought along mounted troops, light artillery, and hussars, a total of 350 men added to the 100 policemen outside the theatre and 150 inside.
Jesus Christ.
So this is for the performance of a play.
I know, it's like a West Ham match these days.
Meanwhile, on the other side of town, a Tammany Hall man called Captain Isaiah Rinders, who was backed by all of the Forrest mob, he mobilised loads of his troops, essentially. And he started distributing handbills and posters that had things, words like, "Shall Americans or English rule this city?"
And Daniel Day-Lewis turned up with his knuckle duster.
Yeah, absolutely, and half a leg of ham that he was going to swing at someone's egg. You know that Daniel Day-Lewis, if time travel was a thing, he would use it to go back in time and go method.
Yeah.
So by the time Macready's play had opened, up to 10,000 people had filled the streets outside the theatre. They fought running battles with the police. They tried to set fire to the building, and then eventually the anti-Macready ticket holders managed to get into the building. And when the theatre fell to their hands, Macready, to his credit, still finished the play in some sort of dumb show and was like, "Right, I'm getting out of here, lads." Popped on a disguise, got out of there.
Popped on a disguise?
Yeah.
Because people were like, "We're looking for somebody who looks like Macbeth, so you want like another costume on top."
Yeah, he left disguised as Puck.
Yeah.
And then off he went. Because the authorities thought, shit, this is going to really kick off, they called soldiers in, they lined up and they opened fire, first into the air and then at point blank range into the crowd, killing many innocent bystanders, many of whom were from the working class. Seven of the dead were Irish immigrants. The report from the New York Tribune the next day said, as one window after another cracked, the pieces of bricks and paving stones rattled in on the terraces and lobbies. The confusion increased till the Opera House resembled a fortress besieged by an invading army rather than a place meant for the peaceful amusement of civilized community. In the end, between 22 and 31 rioters were killed, 48 were wounded, 50 policemen were injured, and of the militia, 141 of them were injured by various missiles. According to a man called Nigel Cliff, who wrote about this in a brilliant book called The Shakespeare Riots, these riots basically furthered the wars in New York between the two classes, and professional actors gravitated towards respectable theatres and vaudeville house and vaudeville houses responded by writing skits on these serious Shakespeare plays. So essentially, this production is responsible for the birth of not just militarised police, but also SNL.
It would be amazing if the American Civil War hadn't been about slavery, but about productions of Shakespeare.
Yeah. And
but then they'd still have slavery.
That's true. Yes. So it's not all I retract that statement. If there's one thing we can say for Shakespeare, at least he is responsible for the end of slavery. Yeah.
That is an astonishing parallel universe that you just created that will definitely be made into a film by the people who made Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
Yeah.
So in the end, Macready was basically run out of town, and although Forrest's reputation was badly damaged by all these people who rioted and led to the death and injuring of scores of people, his style of acting went on to become the predominant style within America and influenced people like Errol Flynn later on, this sort of like dashing, handsome, mustachioed man. So it's an astonishing story. But yeah, my selection is going to be the ill-fated production of Macbeth in 1849 in New York that led to death, injury, and also the death of the English style of acting. So our choices this week for the world's worst piece of political theatre are Barry's February 1601 production of Richard II, masterminded by the Earl of Essex.
You've both gone for Shakespeare.
Yeah. So, someone needs to take him down a peg or two.
We haven't mentioned Brecht all the hour.
Gosh, we haven't. Well, we did there. I'm currently holding a sign saying we didn't mention Brecht.
Yeah.
Dan's suggestion of Barak Theatre's The Factory, an interactive introduction to the Holocaust. And my suggestion of Macready versus Forrest, the bout of the Macbeths in 1849. I think this is a no contest, isn't it? Like I said it about 20 minutes ago, there's no way that we can pick Shakespeare as the worst political theatre. It's tempting. I mean, mine
it certainly had more global influence.
Yeah.
it did. I mean mine sort of affected the narrative of American cultural identity from the 1840s onwards to now, yeah, and created the idea of the American theatrical hero.
I mean, in that sense, quite successful political theatre.
Yes,
Not
without impact, but are we happy with the overriding American narrative in both theatre and cinema in the year of 2018? I, for one, am not.
I think American theatre's pretty rude health at the moment.
No, it is, but I mean, like, the heroic style that Forrest... all I'm saying is that I reckon that in one way or another, Forrest is responsible for every 80s action movie hero. He is to blame for Steven Seagal and Jean-Claude Van Damme. Mate, you're talking me into my option, and I don't have to vote for myself again. I'm not going to go for Richard II and the Earl of Essex, because Richard II's an absolute banger of a play.
Yeah, I really like it.
And the Earl of Essex is the kind of man who would like to win anything.
Yeah.
He's one of my least favourite historical figures.
We can talk about Brecht's production of Richard II. Oh no, hang on, that's Edward II. Move on.
Move on. I mean, this feels like a late bid for you. I love the story of mine, but I've sort of got so much respect for the actors continuing under such duress.
Yeah, that's true.
And I feel that 3,500 years of bearded ancestors would frown on me if I didn't pick your horrifying sounding production Excellent. Of The Factory by Barak Theatre. So that's what we're going for.
I hope they're not listening. One of the reasons that I wasn't sure about naming it was I just thought there were probably some actors in that who were only obeying orders.
Oh. Before we go, the world's worst news this week. We go to Vancouver in Canada, where Guillaume Ray, a waiter in a Vancouver restaurant, has been dismissed for being rude and disrespectful. However, in response, he filed a complaint against his former employer, insisting that actually he wasn't being rude and disrespectful, he was simply being French.
Oh, man.
He said he garnered great feedback from the guests and had been praised for being very professional with his tables, but the restaurant accused him of persisting with unacceptable behaviour, and he'd received verbal and written performance reviews. Mr. Ray insists that he was courteous, but the restaurant manager said the other waiters came into her office on the borderline of tears because Mr. Ray was aggressively checking on their duties. The British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal has granted the waiter a hearing to make his case, having denied application by his former bosses to have the complaint thrown out. To all of that, we say, boof. Before we go our separate ways, Dan, where can people find you and what can they find you doing there when they arrive?
My website is www.danielby.co.uk and upcoming tour dates are on there, so you can find links to when you can come and see my piece of interactive political theatre. It's called Instructions for Border Crossing, touring now. I'll be making a new show or two which will come out next year as well, so it's a fairly quiet second half of the year as I start making new stuff. And I'm on Twitter at Daniel By, doing a mix of politics, theatre, and long distance running.
Lovely, excellent. Lovely stuff. We're all off to go and tar and feather various Macbeths around the country.
plenty to choose from.
Yes, there are. We have industrial amounts of tar and feathers. Until next time. Bye bye.
Bye.
I'm very hungry.
It's all right. We are recording this ad with Ben eating some sort of prawn and rice concoction.
It's called a paella.
Oh, is it a paella?
It's paella.
Paella.
It is the most fun foreign word to say.
Paella.
Paella. Do you know what? We should probably tell people my fun news. The reason I'm eating it is because I've been working very hard, because this podcast is no longer being presented to you by just one maze master. It is being presented to you by two maze masters, a Jedi and an apprentice.
Yes, Ben has joined the cast of the Crystal Maze Live Experience in London, where I've been working for the duration of this show, which I am about to leave in about 3 weeks. So it's a one-in, one-out policy as far as curly-haired podcasters.
Oh, I thought you were going to say as worst foot forward presenters. Like, in about 18 months' time, the Crystal Maze director is going to go, guys, you're going to have to get some new people into your podcast, otherwise the maze will fall to pieces.
That's a digression. Thank you so much, Dan, for doing the show. For
getting ourselves. Cheers, Dan.
Lovely to have him on the show. Do go check out his website. It's very full of his dates and is the sort of synopsis of the different shows he's got on, so you can see which one's coming near you and what it's about and all of that.
Yeah,
he's just a lovely man as well.
Really lovely, really knowledgeable. He is, and like all good theatre devisors, prolific as well. So if you miss this show, he'll be putting it on again. He will do more, and they're always very prescient and charming and funny and heartrending. The day he did our podcast, I went to go see his show. All about Britain's utterly grim asylum system. And it was all of those adjectives that I threw at the microphone just now.
But also worth clapping at the end.
Certainly worth clapping at the end.
If you enjoyed the show, as ever, this is the public information bit. Follow us on Twitter at WorstFoot. Ben is on at Ben Vandeveld. I'm on at BazMaxStay. We're on Facebook as well, WorstFootForward, and WorstFootForwardPodcast@gmail.com. Wherever you listen to us on, thank you for doing that. And please give us a rating and a review, 5-star clicks. And I think someone, by the way,
on our iTunes. They took our advice last week because we have an excellent one sentence review from someone. I really like this podcast and recommend it highly to you all if you enjoy facts and fun. Thank you, the person whose name is just an assemblage of letters. I can't really pronounce it, but that is a perfect one sentence review. If you want to write, if you just want to copy and paste that review and just stick it in below, the work is done for you. That is all.
Is that allowed?
I don't mind. Change a word in it. Facts okay. And frippery.
That's a great idea. But remember, you don't want iTunes algorithm to think you're a robot.
That's true. Yeah.
Unless you are a robot, in which case I say to you 10111001110.
Which translates as greetings, our future overlords.
Correct.
And also, we want to give a shout out to people who've been listening to us on SoundCloud this week. I've had a little look at some of that. We actually can see some of the names on the listenership. Thanks to the likes of Janet Alderman, Louise Blackman, Charles Dean, Nywax, whoever you are, Dan Knight, who we know from Twitter, One Sharper, user 668-668-444-380.
That's definitely the robot, isn't it?
Paul Mooney and Tom O'Dara, they're sort of the top 10 or so names on the list. Thank you all, particularly if you're listening to us multiple times in a month, as some of you are. We really appreciate that.
Yeah, it's bloody lovely of you. I've got a couple of other wee plugs, self-plugs. Firstly, if you enjoy, self-plug, it's a...
I'm sorry.
I'm delighted your mind went to that place.
Can't stop thinking about it now.
I obviously, as a Remain voter, I've got a 3-pin self-plug, but... No, I've got a 2-pin self-plug. Shit, fucked up the joke. Edit everything. Burn the country to the ground. If you enjoy the sound of me, but not Barry, on a podcast... And you would prefer Barry to be replaced by a really kooky, cuckoo-brained goddess of the English, British 1980s alternative comedy circuit. I made that a very long rhetorical question.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
We're
not interchangeable.
No, you're really not. I was lucky enough to be on BBC England's brand new podcast called Knock Knock, where they interviewed comedians from all around England and asked them about how that had an effect on their comedy. I also, as well as being a jury, I talked a lot about being Jewish because I just always do.
Who's the host, Ben?
Oh, the host is Helen Lederer.
Helen
bloody Lederer, who, if you don't know her... look, she was in Absolutely Fabulous. She hung out with Rick Mayall and Aid Edmondson in the 80s. She went with Victoria Wood, I think, as well. She's and possibly the Mary Whitehouse Experience. Anyway,
Podcast is largely Ben trying to recite Helen's CV to her.
It is. Well, no, the podcast is largely me trying to get a word in edgeways.
Yeah,
she's lovely, but as an interview technique, it's a little bit like trying to be interviewed by a very enthusiastic Jack Russell. but she was lovely. So it's called Knock Knock. It's on BBC. Angela Barnes, former guest of this parish, was on episode one. I'm episode two. And do keep listening to her, because actually they've picked... lots of great comedians who maybe you've not quite heard of, and it's a really lovely leg up. Mm. Secondly, I know there's only been one podcast listener, to my knowledge, has come to... Excuse me, no, I'm wrong. Two podcast listeners have come to see me perform because Janet, who you mentioned earlier, is a regular at the Good Chip, my club in Camden. But I'm doing a tour date this week. On Thursday the 26th, I'm going to be at the Comedy Crypt in Norwich. Very excited to go gig there. It's been years since I've gigged in Norwich. And I'm going to be doing my tour show, Sidekick, which is going to be an hour of me improvising and making shit up. That's what improvising is. I will be sharper and less verbose when I do the improvising on Thursday in Norwich that you should come to. Barry, you should speak now.
Ben Vandervelde, who died today. Oh, we have to talk about who next week's guest is.
Yeah.
That's such a shame. I wish it could have ended there. Our guest next week is Gabriel Abulu, the host of the Tree Track podcast. Don't you dare mock my accent.
That is the most... that is the most arborist you have ever said, the number between 2 and 4.
Fuck off, you introduce him then.
All right, next week is the host of the 3-Track podcast, Gabriel Abulu. By the way, also on that podcast pretty soon.
Oh yeah, you are.
Me, Barry and Gabriel went through real hell for you guys for this podcast because we watched so many bad music videos.
Oh yes, we did.
And I'll level with you, The Winner is one of the worst things I've ever watched. I have to pour acid into my eyes to get the stains out. Anyway, if you want to watch some of the worst things or hear about some of the worst things that popular culture has dredged up over the past 30 years, join me, Barry and Gabriel next week when I will be haunting this podcast from the grave.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.